am Susan Penn, Executive Board Member of JCPA and Co-Chair of the Israel and World Jewry International Human Rights Task Force. I am co-chairing this call along with Michael Siegel, Chairman of the Board of the Trustees of the Jewish Federation of North America. Now, as a framework, in the aftermath of the recent horrific terror attacks in Paris, the international Jewish community is once again faced with a cruel reality. In the radical Islamist worldview, Jews can be targeted and attacked both as citizens of the countries they live in and specifically as Jews. Since the attacks, which truly has spurred outrage in France and across the world, there's been an overwhelming outpouring of support from the North American Jewish community. We can be very proud of that. Jewish federations have held vigils and memorial services and are providing philanthropic support to help victims' families. There's been enhanced security at the nearly 500 Jewish sites across France with the help of federations in New York, Chicago, Boston, Cleveland, and L.A., among those that have opened mailboxes for donations. The JFNA is also coordinating closely with the French community leaders as to the appropriate timing for a solidarity mission to Paris. They will email you more information about this as it becomes available, but please visit the JFNA website at jewishfederations.org to learn more and for updates. So the JCPA and the JFNA felt that it was timely and of great importance to give us an opportunity to hear from our esteemed speaker. Ira Foreman is a member of the administration. He was sworn in as special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism on May 20th, 2013. He is an expert in Jewish communal work, having worked 30 years in the field. As a public servant, he has written and spoken extensively on Jewish history and public policy. Mr. Foreman co-edited and wrote for the reference book Jews in American Politics. He also was a fellow in American Politics and the Economy at the Center for National Policy. Ira.
And today's call is off the record.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Susan. And I appreciate the off the record. It gives me a chance to speak more candidly and look at, for example, conversations I've had as late as this late morning that I haven't had the chance to clear at the State Department, because at State Department our public statements all have to be cleared. So let me start by saying I don't hold myself out as the foremost expert on anti-Semitism and this current situation. What you're going to hear today is primarily my channeling other people who are much smarter or actually living through the actual circumstances, as well as the data and other anecdotal material that our office collects and that we review. I'm going to start today with the new. What have we learned in the last week talking to Jewish leaders and others? What new information do we have that gives us a better sense of the state of anti-Semitism and how it's affecting Jewish communities? All this in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo and Kosher Market massacres. And then the second part, I really am going to try to integrate this material into what I would have talked about a week ago, which is our overview of how we're seeing anti-Semitism developing and what type of actions are being taken, not just by the U.S. government, by lots of different governments and NGOs to try to counter this. So first, France in the last few days. I spoke on Tuesday with the head of one Jewish French organization who started off by saying much of our population, Jewish population, is shocked, surprised. How could this have happened? But then that leader actually said, but there's no reason they should have been surprised. We knew this was coming at some point. One doesn't have to be a great scholar to know what happened at the Belgium Holocaust Museum in May and the similarities, it appears, between that perpetrator and the perpetrators this past week. And there were many other signs. And frankly, I probably would agree with her. We're all saddened by this, but I can't say that I'm shocked. about what we've seen. I think the first point that's really important in looking at France right now is the role of the government. And I am happy to say that when I talk to Jewish leaders throughout the past 20 months I've been serving, and as late as September when I was in Paris, and certainly in the last few days in making calls, everybody is very satisfied with how the government has reacted in the last week, in the last year, in the last number of years. And this, of course, wasn't always the case. Decades ago, this was the government reaction to much of this was very problematic. But the access that I hear that Jewish leaders, communal leaders are getting is really phenomenal. For example, when I called a Jewish leader today, he had just yesterday come out of a meeting with the Interior Ministry when they were talking not just about Jewish security, but larger security measures that the whole society has got to be dealing with. When I would be when I would call in July and August to Jewish leaders, when we had riots in the streets and all kinds of anti-Semitic incidents taking place, it literally I would call and people secretaries would say, "Can't talk to you now. He's in with President Halon. I can't talk to you now. He's in with Prime Minister Val." And this was with more than one leader. There were constant access, etc. And the rhetoric, as well as the security, especially after the first week of the riots in the summer, was quite good, and people were happy. And I think it even got better from what I hear in the last week. One of the things, if anybody ever had would complain about government action in France from the community, it would be something like this. You know, they know what's happening, but they are very loath to talk publicly about where the violence is coming from. And the violence is in France is coming from, and certainly the perception of the community, and I think generally perception, is coming from parts of the Muslim community in France. It's not coming from the radical right, by and large, or other anti-Semitic elements. And you would hear from French ministers, for example, when I visited, you know, we do not want, one, we don't believe in Republican France and in distinguishing between different Frenchmen. You're either you're French, and that's all you are. You are not Jewish French or Muslim French, etc. And the other thing is there was a strong feeling that they did not want to stigmatize the whole Muslim community there. It's a big problem with integration, etc. And of course, there is no question that this community is discriminated against when it comes to things like housing and employment, etc. But this past week, you saw a very different line. You saw Prime Minister Valls and others saying very openly that this is where the problem is. And again, also saying the Muslim community cannot be attacked. The Muslim community as a whole can't be stigmatized. And I think that's a much more appropriate. It doesn't solve any problems, but it's certainly a necessary, if not sufficient, way to begin to attack the problem. If you can't say where it's coming from, it's hard to believe you can really begin to get to the roots. So the other thing that I heard from a French Jewish leader just today is that there actually is a realization, which the French community would talk to me all the time about, that though the government's has been very good in working with the community, there's been a great disappointment in the community with the larger civil society. And we'll talk about this, I think, a little more. We perceive that in many of the bad spots around the world, if we're going to be able to really confront this problem, it's going to take more than governments and even more than nonprofits. It needs the whole civil society, whether that's clergy or business leaders or other kind of community leaders. People have to step up. So this week, in talking to two or three Jewish leaders, I will tell you the word that comes up all the time is security. No one's thinking about long-term solutions, as they told me. People are thinking about how am I going to be secure? How are my kids going to be secure? Jewish schools, for one example. On Monday, I was told that in the Jewish schools in Paris, 20 to 30% of the students were absent. Parents kept kids home because they had no feeling that the children were going to be protected. As of Tuesday, there are at every Jewish institution, I was told, in Paris, schools included, there are at least 12 soldiers, and with equipped appropriately and this is a massive undertaking. This, by the way, is not just France. When this happens in France, it goes across borders all through Europe. And as we all know, under the European Union, these borders are open. I talked to a leader in Denmark, which has its own, it's a much smaller community, but its own set of problems. And he, too, said, this was Monday, parents were keeping their kids out of school. And it was mainly, again, Jewish school in Copenhagen. It's most of the Jewish children go to the Jewish school in Copenhagen. Now, we'll talk about other places as well. One of the other points made to me by Jewish leaders in the last few days is there is going to be a need for a totally new mindset among Jewish citizens, but also other citizens. You know, we have, I'm sure you've been in public places where we see public service advertisements saying, see something, say something. That type of attitude that we saw in the United States and after 9/11, and which you see have seen in Israel for at least 30 years, packages left on a bench, everybody's suspicious immediately, and goes to security to say, what is that? That type of mindset has not been in France till now, and there's people I talked to said that is a huge start, and it is in the community itself. Another point that was made to me is cost. The government is going to continue to pay for physical security on buildings, et cetera. But a lot of the other burden, including a lot of it being training of both the full community and people who will have to take more security, volunteer security responsibility, that is going to have to also be very. That's going to be very expensive, and the community is going to be stretched. But I did already hear gratitude from about American Jewish organizations coming to the aid of the community in the coming weeks. So that's what I'm hearing now. But frankly, as I said at the beginning, I don't think a lot has changed. Yes, we're all shocked. We're all kind of taken aback. We're saddened. But I don't think it changes our worldview. So let me spend some time on that right now. If you're going to think about anti-Semitism, at least as we do, the easiest step is to look at the demographics. And most of you have a sense of this. 85% of world Jewry is either in North America or Israel. So the 15% that's left, two-thirds of that is in Europe. And that's where we have to concentrate. In the 20 months I've been on this job, I have traveled to 17 countries, one of which is in Europe. I've traveled in many of these European countries 2, 3, even 4 times. And I have not yet gotten to Latin America, where we also have some significant populations, or South Africa or Australia. Not that they're not important, and not that they don't have some levels of anti-Semitism, but not the same. Where are the hot spots? What are the countries we're concerned about most? There is no formal list. And, in fact, it changes. I would tell you it changed between the spring of last year, before the Gaza episode and the riots in Western Europe, and then after. And even then, I don't have a formal list that I keep in front of me. But one of the ways we look at this, and actually this office probably, at least in the last 20 months, our priority is taking pressure off Jewish communities that are under pressure from anti-Semitism. You know, we could have other priorities, and a secondary priority, frankly, and not unimportant, and would give us and generate us a little different list, is where are the sources of anti-Semitism? And one of the things we see is that we're getting anti-Semitism being generated in places where there are no or almost no Jews. Most of you are not surprised by that. But assuming we're looking at this priority, not the only priority, but our top priority, of kind of trying to take some of the pressure off Jewish communities that are feeling it. Let me tell you a couple places we're looking at. France is obvious. Belgium, Netherlands, Germany. All four of those are Western Central European countries with significant Muslim populations. And that's no coincidence. Greece, Hungary, Turkey, Venezuela, Iran. So before I go into some anecdotes, et cetera, of what I've seen and the nature of anti-Semitism in these places. Let me just say one other thing that I think is really critical from at least our perspective, because this office's job is to tell our leadership of the State Department at the White House, what do we see out there? What is the nature? What's at stake? How bad is it? And it's really, really, really important. I think the most important thing we do, we can't oversell the problem and we can't undersell. We've got to be brutally honest with what we see. Now, to predict the future, none of us are prophets. I've been told that in Judaism, we thought prophecy died about 300 B.C. But we can make some say what could happen in the short term, 5 years or so. I think that if we try to make predictions 10 or 20 years out, silly. But I will say this, important. A lot of people talk about with anti-Semitism now, does it look like the 30s all over again? And in fact, there are some analogies I can give you that would say yes. But ultimately, I think we have to be honest and say, I don't see that we're 5 years from boxcars to Auschwitz, even under a worst-case scenario. I mean, we are having Jews dying in places like Europe just from this last week. But we have Yazidis in northern Syria who are having to dig their own graves and being shot by machine gun. I mean, literally Eisengruber type of activity. So it's not that. But what is it? So I really think the bottom line is this, again, from hearing from people I talk to, if current trends continue, and those are bad trends in the last, certainly last 5-6 years, and probably all through this 21st century, we will see, we could see, Jewish communities in Europe, some of them, disappearing, particularly the smaller ones. Communities that, in some cases, the younger ones are 500 years old. The older ones, Turkey, 2,400 years old. Greece, 2,300 years old. That is a possibility. Now, France is not going away, and I'll talk about that in a second. So let me talk about how we look, kind of give an overview of the world and anti-Semitism. I think the first tool that I look at is, what does history tell us? And I go back to the Soviet Jewry movement, a movement that started among Cleveland Jewry. In the 60s and 70s and 80s, that was a very formidable task, and it's one of the great success stories in history. But I do say, in looking at that and trying to find some parallels, the solving of that problem looks simple compared to what we face here. And the reason why, there was one address that we could go to solve the problem. That address was the Kremlin. We solved it by going through the Kremlin. This is a phenomenon of multiple countries, so there are multiple capitals and governments, but even within one country, I can't tell you a country that I know one address that will solve the problem. One address might have a major impact on the problem, but it's always multiple. Let me give you an example. I talk about data. I'm giving you a lot of anecdotal stories, but we do look at some data. The data is not complete, but there's some decent stuff out there. So one of the best pieces of data is the FRA survey, Fundamental Rights Agency of the European Union. You can see it online in English. FRA survey in late 2012, it's 2 years old now, surveyed 8 Jewish communities in the European Union, representing 90% of the Jewish population. The many, many questions on how they are experiencing anti-Semitism, I thought the most interesting to me was this. Have you considered immigrating from your home country over the last 5 years because of anti-Semitism? EU-wide, again 2 years ago, was 29%. In Hungary, the number was 48%. In France, the number was 46%. Now, just from those numbers, you might think that anti-Semitism in Hungary and anti-Semitism in France are quite similar. And frankly, nothing is further from the truth. Now, I will say this. There are the same. You can find the same types of anti-Semitism. I would say, in general, and this is not a kind of an academic, it's a kind of quick and dirty for usage every day, characterization. I think I see like 4 types of anti-Semitism in almost every type of country. Some may have a few less, but you have your classical right-wing, fascist, neo-Nazi, extreme right anti-Semitism from the typical from the late 19th to through the middle of the 20th century. You have your left-wing, anti-colonial, anti-globalization, sometimes tied to green movements, anti-Semitism. You have anti-Semitism that's clearly connected, often through Muslim minorities, to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And then you have what I would think is populist anti-Semitism, almost that cannot be categorized left or right. You see it in soccer hooliganism across Europe. You see it in someone like the comedian Dieudonné. And in every place, there's a mix of different ones. And which one's more important? I will tell you, in France, French Jews are fearful of violence. Hungarian Jews are not fearful of violence. And let's go through that a little bit. Let's start with France. And let me also say, whenever I look at this material, I look at both, as I said, the anecdotal that we're hearing, as well as data that we get. So I mentioned the Frost survey. I'm going to the other survey that I think other two surveys you can look at is the ADL survey this summer of 102 countries trying to get a measurement of anti-Semitism, an index. It is a really useful tool for us. I will say it's not perfect, and sometimes it's got some flaws in the ADL will tell you that themselves. But they're going to be repeating it. It's going to give us a time sample to start comparing things, and it is. As a general way of looking at anti-Semitism, although I don't think it's a perfect – you can't say 40% of the country is anti-Semitic because that's the number. But it is very useful, and I really, as a general rule, look at it. Also, the American Jewish Committee recently did a very groundbreaking poll in France looking at different segments of the population, like the National Front far right, Muslim populations, et cetera. So in France, we have all four types of anti-Semitism. But violence from Muslims is what is driving the fear, what is driving potentially immigration from France. I thought the key question when we sat down in our the chargé, who is the head of our embassy in Paris this summer, we had the Jewish community leadership and the head of the SPCJ, the French security organization, when we asked, said, what's your future if these trends continue? And he said, we're not going to all immigrate. He said, every single person I talk to, every friend, we talk about immigrating. Now, remember, this is before this past weekend. This is September. We all talk about it, but ultimately, even under the worst case scenario, we're not going to do it, most of us. Maybe 100,000 or 500,000. That doesn't sound so bad, but then he went on to say, but understand, once that happens, we can't raise any money in this community. Who wants to give to a day school for a perceived dying community? But even worse than that, many of us, who are not deeply connected to Judaism as some of us others, many of us, perhaps a majority of us, will quickly assimilate. Because it's very easy for us to assimilate in France. We are generally very assimilated, even keeping our Jewish identity. But why keep your identity when your kids are getting beat up in public schools? If you bring them to a Jewish day school, they have the threat of terrorism. Many of them right now, about a third of Jews I've been told in France, send their kids to Catholic schools because it's the safest place. And that is the worry. I can tell you myself, this over a year ago, on my first visit to Paris, when I left the Grand Synagogue and walked with the rabbi to his house for Shabbos dinner, we all had kippahs on at 7 o'clock. At 11 p.m. when I came down, one of the nicest neighborhoods in Paris, not an immigrant neighborhood, I walked down the street with a kippah on the head of the president of the synagogue, grabbed my arm, said, take it off, it's not safe. And if you're in Sarcelles, one of the suburbs, it's much worse. Let me go a couple other countries, give you a little sample too. Belgium, Frost survey has it 40% would say they want to immigrate. ADL has their number at 27% as an index. By the way, France was 37%. People don't are in Brussels have a hard time if you're wearing certainly a kippah, but even a mug and dove, you can often get harassed on public transportation. People I heard time and time again saying, we tell our kids not to come back. After college, do not come back. There's no future here. And I will say Antwerp is not in the same situation. It's partly, I think it's the nature of the population, the demographics. Brussels, frankly, right now is much more of a Muslim city. Turkey. The ADL has the Turkey ranking index at 69%. There are 17,000 Jews left of a community that used to be 120. Every synagogue I saw that's still being used, and the 17,000 in Istanbul use about 25 synagogues, every single one had blast walls of concrete that could take 2,000 pounds of TNT and collapse the wall but send the shockwave back in the street. As the head of the community said, I understand why our neighbors hate us, because if we get another bomb, and they had a bomb in 2002, I believe, at Neve Shalom, it won't kill many of us. It will kill a lot of them on the street. The school is set up so that the courtyard, the main Jewish school, is a beautiful institution. Courtyard set up with these high, high towers with plywood boards on the top. And I asked, what were those? He said, that's to make sure that no one can get a shot into the courtyard, et cetera. Now, in Turkey, I heard very few people saying, we tell our kids not to come back. But that community is under tremendous stress. I probably worry about that community more than any single one. And during the Gaza war, we had people saying lots of nasty things in the press, et cetera. I won't even talk about the government now. But things like the head of the NGO that ran the flotilla said publicly in the press, the Jews of Turkey will pay the price for Israel's crimes. Hungary, Frost survey, 48% said they've thought of leaving. The ADL survey index is 41%. We don't know how many Jews are in Hungary. Some people at low end say 20,000. It's probably closer to 100. It has a Nazi party, the second largest, I think second or third largest party in parliament, has street militia. It is deeply anti-Semitic. It is a good model on National Socialism. It's not just Jobbik, which is a problem. And Hungarian Jews, as I mentioned, are not afraid primarily of violence, because Jobbik usually beats up Roma. They usually leave Jews alone, at least till now. Greece, just a couple quick other anecdotes. ADL survey has it at 69%. Only 5,000 Jews in Greece. I don't think they feel as beleaguered, even though that index is relatively high. But they have even a more Nazi party with significant parliamentary representation with street militia in Golden Dawn. And the first bookstore I went into in Athens, it looked like a Barnes & Noble. I asked for the protocols. There were two different copies. And, in fact, there are 29 different versions of the protocols today circulating in Greece. I was told any bookstore you go into, they will have the protocols. Venezuela, its ADL index is 30. Its community has been cut more than in half. It's under 10,000 now. The government is deeply anti-Israel, has called Israel essentially a genocidal power. Close ties the community feels to Iran. There have been raids on the community center. The economics are bad. The population is dwindling. Let me mention real quickly Russia and Ukraine. Russia has a 30% index, and Ukraine has a 38% index. Putin has largely, as I've been told, kept the reins on anti-Semitism, traditional. This year, there are some frightening signs. We've had some media, and all media pretty much is state-approved, who have had some anti-Semitic statements, which we hadn't seen in years past. We don't. The people I talk to don't think it's Putin, but it is a bad sign. But so far, there have been few major incidents in Russia. But Russia accuses Ukraine, but also other of its neighbors who it doesn't like the Baltics, of being anti-Semitic. I've gone twice to Ukraine, right before Maidan and right after Maidan, to see look at those charges of anti-Semitic incidents being perpetrated by the government or even by nationalists from fascist, nationalist, neo-Nazi types. Well, probably wouldn't call neo-Nazi, but far-right parties, et cetera, in Western Ukraine. And frankly, we saw in talking to Jewish community leadership, we saw no evidence of this coming out of the government and frankly even not the nationalists who everybody in the community is suspicious of. And I think it's really important we've been speaking up and saying these charges of anti-Semitism are not true, and it is terrible to use anti-Semitism falsely. I will tell you, in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet republics, I've talked about ADL, I've talked about AJC, Simon Wiesenthal, World Jewish Congress are also doing great work in some of these places. B'nai B'rith is doing great work in South America. In the former Soviet Union, I rely on NCSEJ as my go-to people, and have been, frankly, I have a lot of what we learned here have been Jewish communal personnel, et cetera, around the country, who've given us really the benefit of their understanding of their years working here. And I want to say that this problem is not going to be dealt with, as I said before, just by governments, and certainly not just by the United States government, and not by just governments and Jewish organizations. As the head of our delegation to the Berlin 2014 November Anti-Semitism Conference said, this is not a Jewish issue. It is a human rights issue, and unless human rights, civil rights, and other NGOs outside the Jewish community take this on, we're doomed for failure on this in terms of containing anti-Semitism. I've gone on much too long. I was going to talk a little bit more about some of the things we've been doing, but I think I'd like to end it here. I don't want to end it on this note of great pessimism. I think it's true, just from history, that we're not solving this problem. This is not a solvable problem in our generation, and probably not in the generations of our great-grandchildren and their grandchildren. It's been around for at least 2,300 years. It's not likely it's going to be solved, eradicated. But I will say this. We can turn down, if you use the metaphor of a faucet, we're not going to turn the faucet down, but we have a decent good chance to turn it, we're not going to turn it off, but a good chance to turn it down. And I think, as Rabbi Tarfon said to us, we're not required to complete the task, but neither are we absolved from beginning it, and this is the beginning. So I'd love to take some questions now.
Thank you, Ira. This is Mike Siegel, the chair of JFNA. Operator, if you would instruct people how to line up for the queue for Q&A, we would appreciate that now.
Sure. If you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star one.
Yeah, so as we do that, I'd like to take the opportunity to ask the first question. So as you've explained the situation, obviously you've just talked about 2,300 years on a very long horizon and really kind of never fixable. But yet when we see these incidences that come up that are so emotionally charged, as we saw in Paris, can you suggest for us what should the American Jewish community do to be of support?
Yeah.
And then what should we not do so we don't get too far in front of the local community, right, in terms of their necessity to deal with their neighbors?
Well, Michael, I've heard that question that you just asked increasingly in the last few months, even before this, but more and more groups ask me exactly that. Just don't tell us what's happening. Tell us what we can do. And unfortunately, as a government employee at the State Department, it's not my role to tell anybody what to do in specific terms. But I can give you some general things, and let me try to do that. One, educate yourself. It is the most complex thing I've ever dealt with. It's not that you can't wrap your hands around it at some level, but you got to have some really good sense of it. And so, you know, you just all you have to do, for example, is use a search engine and have a daily search for the term anti-Semitism. I don't know if surprised, but you'll get plenty of information. And you just did that, you'd have a good sense of what's going on around the world. But the Anglo-Jewish press in Israel, JTA, there are lots of other aggregators of this out there, and there are a lot of great books that give you the historical background. So the education is the first thing. The second thing I would say is, rather than say you should be doing this or this or this, which I can't do, I would say what I can say is I'm a great believer, and I think we can say this to the State Department, using the classical tools of American democracy, freedom of speech, freedom to petition your government, et cetera. Those are the types of tools that even on this issue, it is not an issue that sometimes at least some of us feel has gotten enough attention. Maybe with an incident like this, that changes a bit. But members of Congress have a role if they think it's important and you think it's important. Let me say that Jewish organizations, if you do your education and you think Jewish organizations you're involved with should be doing more of this, then you can tell them. If you think they're not, there are a lot of priorities I know in this community. There's continuity questions. There's Israel. There's BDS. There's a ton of stuff here. But if you think that a bigger chunk should be anti-Semitism, well, those organizations, and I've talked about these organizations with very small staffs. In many cases, they're doing. We really rely on them. I can't tell you how many times I call someone at World Jewish Congress or NCSEJ and ask them, what do you think of this? And many times they'll pick up the phone and say, this is going on here. What do you think we can do? So they are great resources. And, you know, as time goes on, we change our priorities, et cetera. What not to do? Again, I don't think it's for me to tell you in any given situation. But I will say this. One of the things I've learned, a lot of times when I see outrages, my first reaction is I'd like to blast somebody. I would like to yell at somebody. Often, if it's the easiest thing, frankly, in dealing with some of these problems, is when there are problems with the government. It's not 1930s in the sense that we have lots of anti-Semitic governments in Europe. Not that we don't have anti-Semites in certain governments, but I wouldn't call them the type of governments you saw, say, in Poland in the late 30s. But it's easy to blast them, and sometimes that's the right thing to do. But I think sometimes it's also good to call the local community. We can't have U.S. policy totally based on what a local Jewish community leader says. But I'll tell you, if I call a local Jewish leader and they say to me, don't criticize my prime minister. It's not the way to do this one. You need to do it behind the scenes. There's a big issue of face here, and we'll be better off if you do it this way. Now, maybe I'll disagree, but I got to tell you, I take that recommendation darn seriously. So being educated, being in touch with these Jewish communities, looking at our communal organizations, looking at the tools of democracy, those are the types of things I think you got to do.
Thank you, Ira. Operator, if we can go to the first question on the queue.
Your first question is from Jim O'Fell of San Francisco.
Ira, thanks very much for this briefing. I found it to be very informative, and thanks to everyone who participated in getting this set up. My question goes back to the very beginning part of your presentation. You talked about in France that the government has been and will continue to step up a lot on physical security, which I assume refers to the actual, you know, physical site hardening of whether it's video cameras or bollards in front of doors or those kinds of things.
And we have 10,000, and don't forget, we have 10,000, I don't know if that's the toll number or the Jewish number. We have troops in front of Jewish day schools, in front of synagogues, et cetera, and they'll be there for a while.
Yeah, and I understand. I think I heard 10,000 troops on the streets, 5,000 of them specifically assigned to Jewish sites, I think, is what I heard. I've also heard some different figures for the number of physical Jewish institutional or Jewish identified sites in France, and I've heard a number of 500. I also saw something the other day that said that there are over 700 Jewish schools alone. So two-part question. One is, I wonder if you could comment on that, if you know the number of physical sites. Number two, if the French government and the French Jewish community are sort of covering the physical security site capital costs that are anticipated to be needed. If you could talk a little bit more about you mentioned training in the community and the need to help perhaps with training in the community around security issues, and maybe you could just embellish a little bit on that.
Well, this is not an area of expertise that I have. I do know, that the level of sophistication of Jewish communities in the security area really varies tremendously in Europe. Place like Turkey, people really know what they're doing. They've been doing it for 20 more years. France, in terms of its government participation, Germany, frankly, too, in terms of paying for security, because a lot of these Jewish communities are getting bankrupt by the levels of security they have to do. And often they don't do the most cost-effective because the easiest thing to hire a trained guard than to do a lot of the stuff yourself, volunteer, and know what you're doing right. So I can say I don't know the numbers in terms of the Jewish institutions. I've kind of seen the numbers you were just talking about yourself. I can tell you, in comparison, the CST in the UK does a darn good job, and a big piece of this, and again, JFNA, I know, and other Jewish organizations know this better than I, working with Homeland Security and Justice, and we have tremendous networks in this country, and we have tremendous cooperation between local law enforcement and our Jewish communal institutions. That is not always the case. In some cases, there's almost no connection. And Europe now, with open borders, what happened in France can happen anywhere. And some of these countries, I know of a country, I won't mention it today, that doesn't believe culturally in putting armed guards in front of institutions. And as recently as a week ago. And we have a Jewish community deeply frightened because, frankly, you can't carry a sidearm or a gun without being law enforcement in this country. So we have vastly different types of security situations in different countries, and some of the smaller communities just don't have the financial resources, especially if the government's not kicking in, and a lot of places government doesn't kick in. So you have about the extent, Jim, of my knowledge of the security side. Security is really important. It's what I see is when I talk about making Jewish communities feel better, that's a big piece of it, and it's really it's the first thing that must be done, but it's also a Band-Aid because it doesn't solve the long-term problem.
Operator, can we have the next question?
Your next question comes from Rabbi Moses Birnbaum of New York City.
Yes, thank you. I wonder if you would comment on, you talked about Hungary and just a bit about the Baltic states. Could you comment a little bit about the rewriting of the history of the Second World War in the post-war period, equating the Nazi genocide with what the Soviets did to the captive nations, and how Hungary and the Baltic republics are honoring Holocaust perpetrators as national heroes and actually opening up investigating Jewish partisans who were affiliated with the Red Army and linking them with Soviet oppression.
This is a huge piece. And first off, much of what you say is, I believe, is true. I am not, again, one area I haven't spent a lot of time is the linking of the Holocaust with the communist regimes. There certainly is, that is going on. I am more concerned, particularly in much of Eastern Europe, I mean, all of Europe, which was occupied, there is a problem of coming to grips with your history. And frankly, in places like France, this was huge, say, 30 years ago, and it's not so huge now. In a place like Hungary, it is huge. A place like the Baltics, it's big. But each of these countries are really, really different, too. You look at just the ADL index in the three Baltics, and they're quite different, I think, from about 22 in Estonia up to the mid-30s or higher in Lithuania. And in all these countries, we have this problem. Hungary, which is the biggest in Central Eastern Europe, biggest community. Germany's bigger, but in terms of the former Soviet, former Eastern Bloc, non-Soviet countries. We have, besides Jobbik, we have this, as you said, this huge situation where people don't want to come to grips with their history. And here's an example. There's a woman named Maria Schmidt who has been very involved with the current government's plans on how to commemorate the Holocaust or the Soviet occupation. And some of her writing is quite disturbing. There's been the community itself doesn't want to have anything to do with the institutions that she is involved with. And you get this kind of narrative, yeah, there were some collaborators, but basically this was a Nazi thing. This was the Germans. Well, yes, in every country it was mostly the Germans. But in every country there were some degree or other of collaboration, and locals were hugely involved. As you know, Rabbi, the hugest deportation to Auschwitz really took place in about 6 weeks. Now, it's true, it took place after Hungary was occupied by the Nazis in March of 44. But in fact, there were only 200 German troops in the whole country. And the people who collected 450,000 Jews in 6 or 7 weeks and sent them to Auschwitz were Hungarian gendarmes. And people don't want – They say, why do we have to focus on the negative stuff? Let's talk on the good stories. And I've seen some of this in the Baltics as well. And sometimes you can say, well, this may not directly affect modern-day anti-Semitism, but I am a huge believer that necessary, you got to deal with your history. Every country has some history, including us, we're not very proud of. But there's nothing ashamed of, you shouldn't be ashamed of looking at your history. And if you're not, something radically wrong. And that, I think, does affect the situation of anti-Semitism in Hungary. And this is an ongoing huge problem in Hungary. The Pava Street Holocaust Museum, which the government established and runs, is being starved for funds when kind of propagandy new things, which don't tell the real history, are being lavished with funds. This is a big problem. The curriculum in the school is a big problem. And again, some places are doing much better than others. I have one country I'm working with a lot. It is far from the epicenter of anti-Semitism in Europe. It actually is relatively little. But it also has this narrative that we imported the perpetrators. Well, yeah, it's largely true. But there was a huge piece that the locals had, and they don't want to deal with it. And so anyway, I could go on forever about this. In Eastern Europe, you see it more. But in every country that was occupied, you see some of it.
Next question, operator.
Your next question comes from Henry Rosenbaum of Washington, D.C.
Ira, thank you for your insights and information. You mentioned the tie between human rights and anti-Semitism, and we could possibly throw in the word terrorism as well, all linked together. Several days ago, there was a major demonstration in Paris featuring a number of leaders from around the world, with the notable exception of the United States. Can you provide some insight as to why the administration chose not to send a high-level representative to that event? And what does it say to you vis-a-vis the involvement and concern of the administration, recognizing that the administration itself said we made a mistake?
The answer to can I provide you insight is no, I don't know. I don't work in the White House. And I talked to people in the White House. I talked to particularly our White House Jewish liaison, who's often involved in this. But I can't give you a good answer. I can't. But in terms of what it says, again, not knowing exactly, I don't know what exactly that said. This is what I can tell you. This president has spoken out 3 or 4 times in publicly. His chief of staff on Tuesday night made a commitment on his behalf of essentially turning over every stone, doing everything we can to combat anti-Semitism. The president has publicly said this on numerous occasions. I suspect you're going to see more of it. The Secretary of State has done the same. The Secretary on September 2nd, in the wake of the Gaza riots in Europe, brought in European Jewish leaders as well as American Jewish leaders. There may be a person or two on the phone who was there. To talk to us, and also with our State Department leadership. So we got it was mainly not what the United States was doing. What should we do? What are you seeing? What are you feeling? And the most powerful stuff by far were the three Jewish leaders we brought in to tell us how they're experiencing this stuff. And I think it was a tremendously powerful thing and a piece that helps us drive, I think, some initiatives that we're doing behind the scenes. Ambassador Power from our UN, led our delegation to the Berlin Anti-Semitism Conference in November. It was commemorating the first big one, anti-Semitism conference from 2004, where Secretary Powell spoke. Ambassador Power gave the keynote. She was by far the charismatic speaker there. She is passionately involved in this issue. On January 22nd, she, along with Israel, is leading the charge to have the first ever discussion of anti-Semitism in the General Assembly. And I know, because I'm getting tasked every day to help them prepare, she is really very interested in that we're not just saying things and it's not just words, but how can we follow up? How can we, frankly, she is very committed, I know, to looking at our allies, to look at setting up offices like my office, the special envoy, to monitor and combat anti-Semitism, except for Israel and to a certain degree Germany. No one else has an office just dedicated to combating anti-Semitism. That is only a small piece, but it's an important bureaucratic piece. Ambassador Baer in Geneva, who was our ambassador to the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, is the diplomat who made sure this year's conference, this 2014 conference, happened. He made sure that the suggestions that came out of that conference were voted on by the ministerial committee in December of the OSCE. None of us thought it could happen because they didn't want to vote on anything. The Russians wanted to put all kinds of amendments that would attack the Ukraine or the Baltics. And he got it through. And he has told me he is dedicated in the next year to not just get the recommendations through, but then make OSCE countries start following through on their commitments. Our embassies, I can tell you, and maybe this again goes to Michael's question about what can be done, it is absolutely essential that our ambassadors, particularly, or well, we don't have an ambassador, we have a chargé or a DCM, the second in charge. When I go to a country, if the ambassador goes to meetings with me, if the ambassador has the Jewish community into his or her home to discuss this issue, it makes a huge difference. And I have had embassies, I've gotten calls during the summer, got a call from a rabbi in one embattled European city who said, our local security lost control of the streets last weekend. We are deeply concerned we don't have enough security in our neighborhoods. Can you help us? I called the embassy. The embassy, 24 hours, I got a call back from this rabbi. I said, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's moving already. When you have an ambassador, when you have embassies, and almost all of our embassies have deep, deep ties with even communities that might be no bigger than 800 or 1,000. Every place I go, they have a good connection with the community, but if then they want to act on it, it makes our job here tremendously better. So, look, I couldn't tell you that we are doing everything we can. We're not. No one is. We'll never get to that situation. We don't. Even being the superpower, we don't have enough resources. We can do more. We should do more. But I'm very proud of us on a number of levels, especially even our NGOs. We sent a delegation to Berlin that was made up of not just Jewish NGOs, but significantly was chaired by non-Jews. Wade Henderson is, and had Arab Americans, had Sikh Americans, had Latinos on it. We're the only delegation there that wasn't just essentially 100% Jewish. We have some of the best role models here. We have some real expertise in how you, without hate crime laws, how you beat back hate, and particularly hate speech and anti-Semitic speech. So this is not just a full-throated defense of the president's decision not to go this weekend. But in terms of, I must say, I'm really proud of our country when I look at what we're doing. We can do better. It's my job to make sure that we can do better. In terms of commitment to defeating anti-Semitism, or at least pushing it back, I think there's no country, with perhaps the exception of Israel, and we have more resources than Israel, that is doing more.
Iro, do you have time for one more question or not?
I will stay with you guys as long as you want.
Well, we run out of time. We have time for one more quick question then. Operator, take the next question in the queue.
And your final question comes from Francine Haber of JCRC Denver.
Hi. There's been an effort among legitimate European media and anti-Israel groups to separate out anti-Semitism from anti-Zionism in the way that I think most Jews would think is a difference that makes no difference. I think the recent attacks in Paris are a good opportunity to point out that there's no difference. And I think one thing we could do is get grassroots participation on all outlets such as Facebook and Twitter to have a real campaign to point this out. I mean, I don't think there's anything we can do about BBC or which I listen to, the World Service at night, and it's outrageous. but I think this incident can be exploited in a good way to point out that there's absolutely no difference between anti-Semitism and the terrorists' point of view about Israel.
Well, let me just say, I'm not sure, as I said, I wouldn't be, I'm not, not my job to say, tell people what to do, say, in social media, et cetera. But one of the things that we have in, is U.S. policy here, and it points to the bipartisan nature, I think, of our efforts on anti-Semitism. I just talked about this administration, but the tool I use probably most every day is something that Colin Powell put in here in the Bush administration, and that is we use the Sharansky formulation to define where criticism of Israel crosses the line to anti-Semitism. And very few, if any, other countries do use that. And that is, first off, we believe in treating Israel just like every other country, no better, no worse, no double standards. And so criticism of Israel, sometimes even criticism we might disagree with, is okay. But when Israel is delegitimized, when people say that Israel has no right to exist, of course, other forms of nationalism are fine except for Zionism, that's anti-Semitism. When Israel is defamed, when people say what the Israelis have done to the Palestinians is exactly what the Nazis did to the Jews, you can say that you disagree with Israeli policy toward the Palestinians in here, one place or another. But to say they're Nazis, to like the Nazis of the Jews, that's defamation, and that's anti-Semitism. And then finally, when we treat Israel with double standards. That tool is very powerful, and it is, again, something that U.S. policy is based on.
So I would like to remind everyone that this call, again, is off the record. It's for the participants of the call. I'd like to thank Special Envoy Ira Forman and all of you who have dialed into the call. Obviously, our hearts go out with our brothers and sisters in France and for those that were who have died and have been injured. Our thoughts are always with them and their families. And so on behalf of the JFNA and JCPA, we will continue to monitor and hopefully be effective in terms of assisting Ira in his role. And so as the situation evolves, we will continue to keep all of you informed. So I want to thank you all for joining us today and wish everyone a happy new year and a great rest of the day. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.